So we're on week five in session four, and we are working with the basic concept of field. In the reading for today, we're just focusing on this very short excerpt from the TSK book. And once again, in TSK, generally the word field is not used. There's a little discussion of that in When It Rains. It's there, but it's not a kind of a organizing principle the way that it is in Knowledge of Time and Space in the section we're reading. But the basic idea of a field is the basic value in looking in terms of a field is to put in place or activate, that's a word that I've been using in thinking about this whole program, the basic idea is to activate a relationship or an understanding, let's say it that way, or a vision of space that is fundamentally different from the vision that that we ordinarily have. And the reason for doing that, of course, is because we understand the limitations that come with our ordinary understanding of space. And actually, a lot of what we talk about today, I think, will help give a little kind of a background, maybe you could say a theoretical background, but I hope it's not just theoretical, a background for why it is that our ordinary understanding of space is so limiting and frustrating. So that's our ordinary understanding. We would like to put in place a different understanding, and the way to arrive at a different understanding is through arriving at a different vision. So I'm saying all that as background because I think it's good to just come back from time to time to understanding what it is that we're about. How do we do that? What does this reading have to tell us? I want to focus a lot this morning on just a single phrase because it really got me thinking when I read it in preparation for the class. And of course, that's the way the TSK books often are. There's a particular formulation that doesn't strike you so much in the beginning or the first time you read it or the 10th time you read it. But at a certain point, it just opens up and you begin to think about what the significance is of a phrase or a paragraph or a particular image. So that's what I want to explore here. So the image that I'm interested in is in the very first paragraph of the reading. So the reading starts off, "Mankind has attempted to gain fulfillment in many ways." So that's not the phrase, but what's interesting about that phrase, you could say, is the kind of taking for granted that we are all always trying to gain fulfillment. We are not born fulfilled. We are born or we emerge into the world by the time we've been socialized and acculturated as beings who are missing something, who are lacking something, and we are always trying to fulfill ourselves. That's our situation, and it goes hand in hand with our ordinary understanding of space. So what do we do about this? And how do we go about gaining fulfillment? And the second sentence says, "We generally try to mark out a little personal space to harness the energies of the environment and to encounter and acquire objects of one sort while avoiding those of another." Okay, so the phrase that struck me was, we try to mark out a little personal space. So my question is, or the question that interested me there was, what does that mean? How do you go about marking out space? And what is your circumstance that makes this seem like it's something that's important to do? and you don't have any space, so you have to mark it out. So that's what I want to explore today. And the basic point that I want to work with is that we don't, as selves, as human beings, belong in the world of space, in the ordinary world of space. And by ordinary world here, I really mean the world in which objects show up. So we're born into this world, and we tend to think of what's real as the world of objects, and especially physical objects, right? So you could say, tables are real, chairs are real, human bodies are real. I'm not so sure about human minds. You know, they're real in some sense, of course, and we've looked at that in various ways. But of course, in a strictly materialist view, and by materialism here I mean the view that the only things that are real are the things that are made of matter. So the mind, you could say the mind is real, but that's because it's really just an aspect of the brain. And the brain is made of matter, so okay, we're going to allow that the mind is real because it's based on the brain. But that's the kind of fundamental materialist view, and it's very, very deeply ingrained in our culture. Most people who would be interested in TSK would say, well, I'm not a materialist. Certainly I accept that there are things other than matter. And that's true, but it's so fundamental to the way we think about things that what's really real, you know, what we can count on is matter and the world of objects in physical space. That's so deeply ingrained that it makes it very, it penetrates into the way we think about things. And even when we deliberately set out to expand our horizons and say that there are other possibilities, we're still holding on to that in a very fundamental sense. And in particular, we hold on to it insofar as we have a model of a subject knowing objects. Now, our culture is not the only one that has that model. I'll say a little more about that in a minute. You know, in Buddhist thought, this notion of the self as the subject grasping, you know, trying to hold on to things in the world is very fundamental. And really, you know, that's pretty much what we're talking about here. But in our culture, because of this materialist bias that we have, it's particularly challenging for the self to establish itself in the world, it seems to me, because what's real is the objects in the world. So the model that you get, and the way that TSK talks about this, and we've read some things about this, the model that you get is the bystander and the outside stander. That's the way it's talked about in the first TSK book. So the self is the bystander. And the word bystander, I think, is very nice. In English, it suggests this idea of being removed, not involved at all, being kind of innocent. We often say an innocent bystander. Just detached from what's going on. In terms of our sense of how the self operates, this notion of the self as bystander is really problematic because, you know, the self has its own sphere. And this goes back to Descartes, who really did put the self into its own domain. You know, there are the things that are extended in the world that take up space. And then there's the self, which is just this thinking thing that doesn't exist in the world. That's the fundamental model. And that's what we want to challenge. So actually at the very end of this reading, Rinpoche writes that what we're ready to do on the basis of this discussion is to make an existential challenge, is to existentially challenge this bystander, outside stander view. And then he introduces exercise 15. We didn't go into that. That's the, I think it's called the mountain retreat exercise, but it's usually known as the big sky practice. And anybody who's interested in exploring that, go out and find yourself some sky. And it's a wonderful practice. But what we're looking at is the kind of foundation for that. And also, and I'll have more to say about this later, the way that we're approaching this, because we're not doing it in a retreat setting. You know, the big sky practice is specifically a practice to be done on retreat. We're doing it differently. So we'll talk later about how we're doing it. But first, I want to go ahead and set up the model or the way of thinking about this. And as I say, it all grows out of this notion that what we try to do is mark out a little space. So why do we have to mark out a little space? Well, it's because we don't have any space. We don't exist in the world in the way that objects do. Here's the self. We have a very strong sense, of course, of our own being, our own existence, but we don't show up. We don't operate in the world in the same way that things do. We can identify ourselves with our bodies. That's one way to try to show up. And that would be an example of marking out a little space. Well, we say my space is the space of the body. And now I feel a little better because, you know, the self is in the body and now I exist if I'm willing to make that identification. We go on to mark out space in other ways that really have to do with the sense of mine, the word my. You know? So we say my body, my house, my car, my husband, my wife, all of that, the role or the function that the my plays there is this marker. You know, we're creating a little space that's ours. So Michael makes a point, and this is a very good analogy and helpful to think about it. He writes, for animals, marking out space is a social act, telling others of the same species, stay away, this is my domain. So what Michael's talking about is animals spray urine. You know, cats do it, dogs do it, I'm sure many other animals do it too. And they do that to mark out space, you know, by smell. They have their own unique smell, and other animals are told, you know, this don't enter here because this is my space. So Michael says, goes on to say, when humans mark out space, are we mainly telling ourselves the conditions in which we feel safe, supported, and identifiable? I wonder how social, looking for confirmation from other people, is our model of marked out space. Yeah, that's a really good question. I haven't been thinking about it so much in terms of social interactions, but I do think it's relevant. The thing that always comes to my mind when this kind of concern comes up is something in a play by Jean-Paul Sartre, who was famous in the 60s. He's not so well known nowadays, but he wrote a play called No Exit, and there's a very famous line in that play where he says, "Hell is other people." And the way that I understood that line back when I read the play or thought about it was we give power to other people. You know, we let our identity be determined by whether other people acknowledge it, so that our claim, our my, has to be affirmed by other people. And once we've given them that power, then they have power over us. They can affirm it, they can deny it, they can distort it. And so that's what I understand the significance of that line, hell is other people, to be. So there is a social element. And what I just said, you know, is just one little quick reflection that I happen to have in my toolbox or storehouse of reflections. So I pulled it out here, but I don't mean to suggest that that's a final or comprehensive comment on Michael's point. The social dimension of the my and of how we mark out space is really important. I'm not going to say any more about it right now, but I would love it if somebody wanted to explore that more. So I'm looking at this, the way in which we as individuals mark out space through the my. But what's interesting about that is that when we do that, we're kind of pretending that we can take the self which doesn't operate in ordinary space, and we can project it out into the world through this my activity, my body, my friends, and so on. But it doesn't really work. That my that marks out space, that my that's the bystander, that's withdrawn, never really does enter the world. At least this is how I've been thinking about it, not only in preparation for this class, but how I've been thinking about it for quite a while, actually, and trying to explore it. What happens is that we project a self. And I think it's a really interesting point that I'm sure most of you know, that the word person comes originally from the Greek word for mask. And you might think of it this way, that in order to show up in the world, you have to put on a mask. And people can see the mask. They can't see you. You're the bystander. You're off at a distance. But the mask, once you have your mask out there, and that mask is your persona, and then it becomes, in English and most other languages, Western languages have this word, I think, once you are out there with your persona, that's the person you are. And so then people interact with each other as persons, person to person. Right? So the person is the one who marks out space. The I, the sense of self, identifies with that person, but really, it doesn't work. You know, the person is not the self. The self remains cut off from reality. And so I think that goes back to the first sentence in this paragraph. We're always looking for fulfillment, and we never get it because we never really enter the world. You know, we're always this cut off self, you could say, an alienated self. And so we contrive to enter the world by becoming persons. And that works up to a point, but only up to a point. Sometimes it's more fulfilling than others. So there's a very useful discussion for those of you who are in the teacher training or who are doing the extra assignments. I urge you to go back and look, and I think we did read this chapter already, but go back and look at chapter 5 in Love of Knowledge, which is called Binding Through Identity. And it's really about this. The language is not the same, but I think it gives you a lot of interesting insights into how this process works. And in particular to the notion that the self is really withdraws into a kind of a black hole or a black box. You know, it's really in its own separate realm. And a lot of the problem that we have as selves is trying to bridge the gap between that separate realm and the world. So Remco asks a question, a couple of questions here, or a question. Are you saying there's a real self which cannot enter the real world? Well, okay, there's a interesting question there, definitely. What I would say is that there is a self that's more real than the person. Than the personal self, if you want to say it that way. Because that's the persona. That's the one that gets projected out into the world like a mask. And then there's the one that's doing the projection. So let's call that the self. And then the question is that self real in some fundamental sense? And I think the answer to that is no. But it's as real as the objects that we encounter in the world. As we go into the world, we, on the one hand, there are objects, and on the other hand, there's the self, or you could say the subject, which is another word we might use, the subject and the object. And they're both constructs. Well, if I say construct, that maybe is going to get us a little confused. They both arise out of a certain orientation to experience. They, you know, things happen and we need to make sense out of them. And the way that we ordinarily, typically make sense out of them is in terms of a subject experiencing or aware of objects. So that truth is real on its own level, but it's still a construct. And I'm using the word construct again. It's still a way of making sense out of something that could be understood in a very different way. And the whole field approach to space, I think, doesn't rely on subjects and objects. So let's, there have been several questions that have come up, so let's take a look at those. So Michael asks, is what I'm talking about related to the idea of self-image? So Rinpoche, in a number of his books, in what's usually called the Nyingma Psychology series, talks about self-image, and it's different from the self. So Michael says, well, is that what you're talking about when you say persona? I think probably yes, but I'm not ready to say that for sure. And the reason is that I think it's always very dangerous to say this is the same as that. You know, you're taking something that's in one domain of language, you know, that sort of depends for its meaning on a whole set of structures, and then you're trying to line it up one for one with a term that shows up in a different domain. And, you know, that's never going to work quite right. But it does make sense to me to say that you know, that would be a way of thinking about it. And, you know, the word self-image is one that I've thought about a lot. This goes a little bit outside the range of TSK because that's not a term that's used in TSK. But I don't think it translates a Tibetan term. I think it's something that Rinpoche developed as a way of helping to make sense out of the Western mind. And this notion of persona, I think, also is something that is especially important for the Western mind. I wouldn't want to say that it's only in the West that we have this, but I do think that this particular structure is characteristic of Western ways of thinking. Okay, Karen says, isn't the meaning of marking out personal space telling the founding story? Okay, well, here's another place where we say, can we equate these two things? And again, I would say that it's very related. Yeah. I don't want to say, yes, that's exactly the same thing. That's what I've been trying to say. And why did I bother to focus on this term when I could have just said founding story? You know, when you use a different vocabulary, you see things through that vocabulary. And that means you see things a little differently. So I don't want to equate the two, but yes, if you want to try to understand what this phrase might mean, then the notion of the founding story, and the founding story, Rinpoche is very clear about this, it's in Love of Knowledge and also in Dynamics of Time and Space. The founding story is here I am. And so that does make a lot of sense to equate the two, because you'd say, well, you know, that's where you mark out some personal space. You've got, this is my here, darn it. You know, this is exactly what I've, you know, this is what I've worked so hard to do. It's something we do from the very beginning, but it's hard work. And that's another reason you could say that we're fundamentally unfulfilled or are always seeking fulfillment, because we have to work very hard to do this thing, which in fact we can never fully do. We can never really in a satisfying way emerge into the world, because the setup of subject and object is that there's this barrier that we're never going to be able to cross. Okay, Sudhi says, I wonder if a baby can learn from an enlightened parent. Well, you're presupposing the possibility of an enlightened parent here, but let's see where this goes. I wonder if a baby can learn from an enlightened parent how to show up and be real and not get disconnected from the contact with everything, an illuminated way of being. Well, yeah, I wonder too. I don't know, you know, that we have examples. There's an interesting example in Western intellectual history. Jean-Jacques Rousseau wrote a book that had a huge influence in the 18th and 19th centuries called Émile. And the idea was something like this, that you're supposed to take, you know, that parents or adults who really have a kind of an enlightened view of what's possible and are intent on raising children so that they don't so that they don't fall into the same traps that most people fall into, or aren't bound with the same chains that most people are bound by. That's more a Rousseau phrasing. If you raise them in the right way, then that won't happen. That's the theory. Now, as I recall in Émile, and I haven't read Émile, I've only read about it, so don't take my word for it. But as I recall, Émile actually, when the time comes for him to enter society, it doesn't work out so well. So whether that actually works, I don't know. Okay. Hayward says, once we are out there, so once we've marked out our space, right, we need to both express ourselves to the world and protect ourselves. This is a frequent psychological struggle and consequence of conventional knowing. Well, that's a really interesting connection. I'm gonna take your word for that. That particular way of phrasing it, but it makes sense to me. That on the one hand we have to keep projecting and expressing ourselves, and in a certain sense you could say, well, we never do because it's only just a mask. You know, we can never emerge from behind the mask because the self can't emerge. So you know, we can't fully express ourselves, and we need to protect ourselves. That's interesting. I'd have to think about that. Okay. Let's go on. I think we've mostly, I've brought out most of what I want to say here, I think. I did say that this has to do especially with Western ways of thinking. And let me just kind of speculate about that for a minute or two. I think part of the reason for that is that in most cultures, the space that we emerge into or try to emerge into is a space that is meaningful because it's inhabited, if you want to say it that way, it's inhabited by God or by something divine. Right? We don't have that. For us, the option is a meaningless world of objects, or the self with its demand for meaning, which it then has to project out into the world. And of course, you know, there are other human beings in the world. So what I'm saying is not strictly true. But when you talk about a world which is inherently meaningful because it's somehow shaped by a divine purpose or a divine presence, then this idea that we have to project ourselves into this world and somehow project our demand for meaning into the world, it doesn't have that same urgency because we can find meaning in the world. And I think that's one reason why in religions, you're very often wanting to connect to the divine, because that's a different way, and in some ways I think a much more powerful way of really making, being at home in the world. You know, this question of making a space for ourselves shows up or comes up especially when you live in a world that doesn't have this dimension of meaning readily available. So we have to somehow make it happen. And it's a struggle, to go back to the word that Hayward used. And there's something else that I think is interesting to think about there. In the West, we develop a particular art form which supports the whole idea of the self as being an outside, a bystander. And that is the perspective model. We develop perspective. We learn how to draw, you know, with a vanishing point and to see things in perspective in a kind of three-dimensional way, which no other culture really ever developed. And it seems as though part of what's going on there is as we begin to develop this bystander model and really withdraw from the world, then we start to see the world in that way. And it's a very different way of seeing the world. So I'm not saying that you know, people learn to draw in perspective and then this whole shift takes place. I'm just saying that's an interesting place to see that there is something about our culture that is particularly susceptible to this way of this kind of problematic. Did somebody want to say something there? Thought I heard somebody. Well, okay, here's Michael does want to say something. He says, he's responding to Hayward. So Hayward said, you know, we have this twofold need. We need to express ourselves to the world and we need to protect ourselves, I guess, from the world. And that's a struggle that comes with our ordinary way of knowing. So Michael says, Hayward, perhaps the mask is our attempt to protect ourselves, since our mask is an attempt to hide our vulnerability and inadequacy. But at the same time, a mask can never satisfy our desire to express our true self. Yeah, I think that's why the notion or the metaphor of a mask, you know, which is so central if you really think about it, because this, you know, we use the word person all the time, and we're really, that's really talking about the mask with which we present ourselves to the world and to ourselves. You know, we begin to believe that that's who we really are. That mask, you know, we keep trying to make it absolutely true, but it's never true because it's a mask. And yes, it protects us. And yes, it's an attempt to express ourselves. And, you know, it's just inherently very problematic. Okay, so let's talk about the alternative, right? The alternative is essentially, in terms of what we've been talking about, space as a field-centered way of understanding space. Now, you know, you can go beyond that and say, no, a great space perspective. That's what Rinpoche is introducing here in the first TSK book. And a field-centered way of understanding space is only, let's say, second level. It's not great space. But it is a very strong move in the direction of great space, because when you experience the field as field, then the distance between subject and object and the two different realms that are inhabited by the subject and object, that whole structure, that whole understanding just falls away. It's you know, Rinpoche talks here about when you can understand everything as space, that's opening and it's liberating. And that's really what I'm talking about here. Why is that? Well, because in a field-centered perspective, the self is out there along with everything else. And it's not even true, it's not even quite accurate to say the self is out there, because the self is really the one, the model that we come up with. This goes back to Renko's question. The self is a particular understanding that emerges out of this separation of the sense that we're cut off from everything around us. And we inhabit our own space. If our experience is part of the field, let's just switch to a field vocabulary because it works a lot better. If our experience is part of the field, then there's no separation. There's not even anyone to be separated. You know, let's say we're talking about some of the factors that come up in our experience are wants and desires, but maybe those change in some ways, but let's not worry about that right now. But, you know, our wants and our desires and our thoughts and our wishes and our intentions and our concerns, all of these things that we would ordinarily say are part of our subjective reality and don't show up in the objective world, in a field-centered way of experiencing or understanding space, that division doesn't hold. Everything is available in the field, and the distinction between subjective and objective just doesn't work anymore. It doesn't count in the same way. And that's really the fundamental shift, it seems to me, that a field-centered approach has. You no longer think in terms of rigid partitions, and Rinpoche talks about that, let's see, on page 92. And he says something very interesting, and I want to say this, and then I want us to take a little time for practice. He's talking about how we can challenge our ordinary presuppositions, right? And at the top of page 92, let me go back to the bottom of page 91. At the bottom of page 91, he's talking about this alternative, and he's talking about a different vision, right? And he says the notion of a person and the notion of a world are too fixed to be suitable for discovering space, right? And earlier, he's talked about trying to inhabit this tiny region of space, trying to mark it out and make it ours, won't work because we miss the underlying liberating dimension, which is space itself. So then he talks about joy and fulfillment, and that, I'm saying, has to do with the space perspective. He says this vision is couched in more fundamental terms than those which simply assert people, places, and things. So in a field model, you know, all of those elements show up, but they're not the reality. They're not the substance, or the very notion of substance is different. And then he says there is a way to discover this. The way to discover it is that we have to challenge the ordinary structures. And he says that this challenging is itself the pathway. So I'm on page 92 now. He says rigid and opaque partitions define all the things and orientations of our realm. But these same partitions also constitute the doorways to higher spaces. And then he says something that I think helps explain what's going on in the TSK book, and also helps explain what we're doing, and they're not quite the same. He says, in order to do this, in order to challenge our usual understanding and open ourselves to space, we have to do a lot of work. He says, by working with what we take to be individual items, we're led to face the other related factors of ordinary appearance. So we're first inclined to seek great space within selected items. Trying to penetrate these, we notice other factors that we take into account. I think that's a very good description of what happens in the first TSK book and what's been happening in the space section. Remember, it starts with the giant body. And then it moves on to more to the interior world, to thoughts, the space between thoughts, and then it opens up to a whole range of possibilities. And I think you could say exactly what Rinpoche says here. You start by challenging a particular set of structures, like the structures of the body, and then you go further, and then you go further, and then you go further. And then you move on to a different set of structures. So it's this sort of one at a time. You disassemble the elements that we ordinarily use to rely on, that we ordinarily rely on to make sense of our reality. We're not doing that. So I think it's helpful to see or to reflect, let's say, on whether that's what's going on in the first TSK book. But if it is, that's not really what we're doing. And that's partly because we just haven't started with the first TSK book and worked our way through. We haven't done it that way. And partly because I do think that the first TSK book asks a lot of its reader in the sense that, this is not something that happens quickly. You need to commit a lot of time to it. And the first TSK book really asks people to make that kind of commitment. We're taking a more global view of how we can approach the openness of space. We've, and in various ways, we've been exploring that in this session by looking at space as a field. Because if that vision of space, if you can activate that vision, then whatever shows up will show up within the field, and it will have a kind of a field dimensionality to it automatically, you could say, undermines our commitment to the reality of things. So Klaus says here, he says too that we can open everything. Yes, that's exactly right. And the point he's making here is not you open up this little thing over here. You know, it's not like it's like you have a lot of cans and you take the can opener and you open one can after another, one can after another, one can after another. That in itself is not the point. The point is that as you open these individual elements, you begin to understand something about how everything is constructed. So the goal is the same. I'm just saying we have we're taking a somewhat different approach to it. So Klaus says, Rinpoche says, we can open everything simultaneously too. Yeah, that's right. And I think that that's closer. That's closer to what we're trying to do here. So let's take a look. I lost something in my notes. Basically, what I'd like us to do at this point is ask how we can do that. Not so much challenging individual items. And the answer, I think, has been clear from what we've been doing up until now. And let's just take a minute to look in a very simple way. This is also something that you can explore at so many different levels. So the issue here is, can we put in place a field perspective on our experience? And you could do that at so many different levels, and that's related to what Rinpoche says here. You could look at different kinds of entities. But let's just do it in a very simple way, and we've done something like this before, for a couple of minutes here. Kind of settle back, relax, and just ask yourself, what is the feel of the field? And that may lead you in the first instance to something like your mood. You know, do you feel alert? Do you feel tired? Do you feel restless? Do you feel relaxed? Do you feel excitement? So the mood is an important element, because moods don't have this kind of very tight structure that things like tables and chairs do. And they have a pervasive quality. So they're a good way into the field. But then as you become aware of that, just kind of look around or let your thoughts roam and see, what is the feel of the field? And whatever object comes up, maybe it's a thought, maybe it's something you look at, what does that contribute to the field? How does it fit into the field? That's the practice. Let's do it for about 3 minutes, and then we'll see what people have to say. Okay? Okay. So, as usual, we're running a little late, so we don't have time for too many comments. Well, we have time for lots of comments if you want to make them. I'm not sure exactly how far we'll get into it. I do see a couple already, so let me turn to those. So David says, feeling relaxed, feeling gradually more open, noticing the expansive sky outside, seems to expand my feeling of space, of a kind of openness. Feels light, feels good, opens to an awareness of my senses, the sounds around me, the feel of my body. It opens to a field of feeling and awareness of more content, too. Yeah, that's a nice description. I think it's fair to say that to open to the feel of the field is a kind of a relaxing and opening experience. We are not so committed to the identities we encounter, and those identities ordinarily kind of swallow up our awareness and actually swallow up our appreciation also. So that's nice. Hayward says, the feel of the field is influenced by what shows up in the field. The field expresses as all appearance. Yeah, I think that's a very interesting interplay because, it seems naturally the case that what shows up in the field, if we have a field orientation, then certainly everything that shows up participates in the field. And in showing up, shapes the field. So there's this interplay, this dynamic. And of course, it's important to remember that the field isn't the thing because things show up in the field. You know? So there isn't anything separate from everything that shows up. The field is the field of what appears. But it has this field quality. So that back and forth, I think, is a really interesting place to explore. Eliana writes, perhaps we can change the self bystander as reference point to the feel and then have access to space in other ways, more open, touching the quality of space instead of labeling it according to our sense of pleasure and pain. Yes, it's a really important move. You know, I haven't really tried to go there at this point, and I'm not sure we will in this session. Too much, but I did say at one point earlier today that the field encompasses our reactions, including our likes and dislikes and all of that, and then I think I tried to point out that may not be the final word on things, because when we look that way, we still are very much taking a self perspective. So we'd like to be able to explore exactly the possibility that you describe here, Eliana, that what happens if the self is not the reference point in the feel of the field. So you could imagine many ways of doing that. One way would be to let the objects, the things that we encounter, let them speak for themselves. So just to use an exercise as an example, you all have come across the subject-object reversal exercise. If you see that in light of the field, I think that helps you understand what's being suggested. Or actually the one right before that, if I remember correctly, in the TSK book, which is the object and its glow. That glow, which is described as having to do with the sense of self, but it can also be understood as the feel that emanates through the field. And it has our reactions as part of it, but it doesn't have to be committed to a self. Okay, Klaus says, there's quite a few comments here, so we'll try to do them. Klaus says, for me, the feel of the field has the taste of restriction and limitation, while the feel of space has a quality of temporal openness. Okay, well, that's really good to explore. I think that sometimes when you look or when you ask yourself about the feel of the field, what you experience is a feeling of restriction, just as you say, because that's our ordinary take. Our ordinary take is a restricted take. And I think that that can open up if you continue to allow for a field inquiry, a field way of experiencing, then the restriction, understood as a field phenomenon, if you want to say it that way, becomes less restrictive. It becomes a way in which the field is manifesting. I'm not sure about the distinction between the feel of the field and the feel of space. That may be very meaningful for you, Klaus, and you know, you may want to work with that. I would tend to say that the field is space, and in a, maybe you could say that what we're trying to do is open up more and more to the space dimension of the field rather than the restrictive dimension, which is more connected with specific identities. Sudi says, let's see, I'm trying to see, we have a few more. Sudi says, when I inquire in the mode of what is the feel of the field, the sense of expanding in the molecules of the air shows up. Feelings of realness show up, connected to what appears, like the velveteen rabbit explaining to the skin horse how one becomes real. Well, I understand your reference, kind of, but I haven't read that, so I don't know what it is about the velveteen rabbit. But the feeling of realness is actually a very interesting place to explore. Michael says, the field of time, that's something we haven't really talked about yet, but we're getting ready to make a transition into time in the next session. The field of time allows an alternative to the pressure of deadlines, acceleration, which are the objects of time. Yeah, that's nice. That's an interesting point. You know, the I won't try to say anymore. The field of knowledge allows an so he's talked about the field of time. So that's an alternative to deadlines and acceleration. The field of knowledge is an alternative perspective to the things we believe we know and don't know, which come to mind as delineated objects. Yeah, I'm not going to try to comment on that, partly because we're running late. But I think that's great. That those are very interesting things to explore. And John says, all my subjective experience is now the field and coexists completely with all other appearings of the field, which really takes the gravity out of my subjective load, so to speak. I feel more with everything. Yeah, those are exactly the kinds of experiences to explore. That's great. I think, you know, it seems as though people have a sense of how to work with this. And that's what we're always interested in is how do you work existentially, as Rinpoche says here, with this different vision, this different kind of understanding. And it looks to me that people have a real good sense of that. So I'm pleased to see it. Okay, that's it for today. Thank you.